white soul brother, they called him. He put the soul in the music.
Bert Burns. One of the greatest songwriters of all bloody time. You know, he's as simple as that.
The guy was a genius.
To be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and tonight, there's no Kyle, there's no Mike, there's no Murray, there's no April, there's no Christy. It's just me and my guest. So tonight I have, I'm so excited about this show tonight. I got to tell you, you know how much I talk about Rock Docs on the show, and I've seen a great one. It's called Bang, the Burt Burns Story. And tonight I have one of the co-directors who also happens to be Burt's son. Okay, so before we start, I'm going to throw it over to the booth and we're going to hear Wes Anthony do his thing, and he's going to promote the Shure SM7B microphones. Wes, take it away.
This episode of the Rock Solid Podcast is brought to you by Shure, the company behind some of the world's most iconic microphones, earphones, and audio products, including the legendary SM7B mic that we use to record Rock Solid. The SM7B offers perfect response for music and speech in all professional audio applications. Used to record Michael Jackson's Thriller album, engineers and artists continue to choose the SM7B for warm and rich vocals. And it also shines on just about anything you put through it, such as guitar, bass, kick drum, horns, and even as a hi-hat mic. For 93 years, Shure has been the go-to company for roadworthy superior sound. Every member of the Rock Solid Podcast is proud to use the SM7B microphone because we care about bringing our listeners the best sound possible.
All right. Thank you, Wes Anthony and Steve-O Dockerson over there in the booth. Let's welcome Brett Burns. Brett, hello.
Hello, Pat. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Now, my fear tonight, Brett, is that I'm going to call you Bert because it is. I told my wife that. I go, I'm going to call him Bert. I know I am, but I'll try not to. Brett.
It happens at least once a day that somebody calls me Bert, so I'm really used to it. I take it as a compliment.
So you sent me a Vimeo link so I could watch this this documentary, which currently has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is thrilling in itself, I'm sure. And then and also then when you see something that's 100%, you're like, oh, come on, this is 100. This is out and out 100%. I've watched it at least almost three times.
Wow.
And my wife's like, didn't you just watch that? I go, I know. And I was watching it right before I left because I was trying to find this this sound bite from one of the guys. I think his name was, it's just such a funny old school sound up which guy is it? Don Droughty of Dante and the Evergreens. I think that's him. He said something about your dad, like something about the you might know it because you probably lived with this film for years. Something about rocket ships on his sneakers or something. It was just the funniest turn of phrase that I've heard, and I really wanted to find it. I couldn't find it. So
yeah, Don Droughty. He says your father had rockets tied to his roller skates. So he was on fire. Yeah.
Rockets tied to his roller skates. I'm going to try to use that in my everyday life.
Yeah, Don is amazing. He was the lead singer in Dante and the Evergreens that did the song Alley Oop, and he and my dad were close friends when they were both just getting started and hadn't even had any hit records yet or anything.
Now let's talk about, for people that haven't seen this yet, of course we don't want to give the whole story away, but I do want them to know that we're talking about your dad, Burt Burns, founder of Bang Records, and has written songs that you probably don't know that he's written. And I'm going to tell you, I'll tell you real quick, in 2016, I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction because my favorite band is Cheap Trick.
Wow.
And my friend's favorite band was Chicago. So we went and they inducted your dad, Burt Burns. I have to be honest, I was like, who's Burt Burns? That's what I said. I said it out loud. I'm like, who's Burt Burns? And then little Steven, you know, listed some songs, and I was like, okay, that guy deserves it.
Yeah.
But that's how I guess your dad's career is, because his career, he passed away young, and his career was on fire, but it was very short lived.
Right.
How long, how old was your dad when he passed?
He was 38 years old.
And he, when he was a kid, he contracted rheumatic fever.
Right.
And that plays, that puts scarring on your heart. Is that what it does?
That's right. That's correct.
And so, if he wouldn't have contracted that, who knows? He would be 88 right now by my count. And in this film, I can't believe how many of the guys are still alive and kicking, and they look fantastic.
They really look great. It's amazing.
So, so your dad gets rheumatic fever. I don't even know how you get rheumatic fever.
He just like a strep throat. It was something as simple as that before penicillin. And, you know, if he got that, it was like a death sentence for a lot of people before, you know, the advent of modern medicine. Bobby Darin, same thing.
So he was actually, he lived a long time for having this, because they didn't think he would live that long. And man, did he do something with his life.
Right.
I mean, in the, you know, look, you and I are both older than your dad was when he passed. You and I are the same age. And man, he packed it in.
He did. And I think, you know, knowing that he had that limited amount of time and that ticking time bomb of a heart, that I think that's what motivated him to live life like there was no tomorrow and to pack as much in as he could. And I think that's responsible for that incredible 7-year run that he had and all that output of music.
And how old were you when your dad passed away?
I was 2 and a half, and my sister was 10 months old, and my little brother was 2 weeks old.
So if they don't have any recollection then.
None of us do.
I was going to say, even when Michelle Kath was here, she said the same thing. She was like your age, and she's just like, not really.
No, my sister in the film, she says, all of my memories of my dad are someone else's, and I feel the same way. It's like, I feel like I have memories of him, because I heard all these great stories all my life, but... Right. It really is. We've kind of recreated a memory of a person we never knew.
And I mean, it must be like in this film, there's actual audio of your dad from the producer's booth. When you found that, I mean, that must have been incredible to hear your, I mean, maybe there were tapes or home movies or stuff, or maybe there weren't, but
there weren't.
But when you came across this, that was quite a find probably for you to hear your dad's voice.
Yeah, that was one of the most incredible discoveries that we made along the way. It was, you know, sort of his voice and outtakes with Betty Harris session. And I had heard him singing on some records, but I'd never heard his spoken voice. And so I still cherish that discovery almost more than any other.
And in the film, a couple of the guys say that your dad's singing voice, it was just okay.
Yeah. Some people like
that's
it,
that's but. Coming from me. I can't sing at all. Do you, what about you? Do you sing?
Oh, never. No way. I can play guitar, but I will never, you will never catch me singing.
So, he was born, Bertrand Russell Burns.
That's right.
But he wrote under a couple different, names, right? Why was that? He was Bert Russell and then Bert Burns.
Yeah.
Does that get crazy with the publishing and all that stuff? Or was he eventually able to tie it together under one name? Or how's that work?
Well, it's one of the ongoing mysteries, you know, is like, why did he use so many different names? I mean, he had Russell Bird as a performing artist, but Bert Russell was his songwriting name and Bert Burns was his producer name. And we've heard different things, like, you know, maybe he was going to use one name as a BMI and was an ASCAP. I mean, there were all these different reasons. But in the end, after about 1963, 64 onward, he only wrote and produced as Bert Burns. I guess he must have figured out, like, you know, Keith Richards says in the outtakes that we have in the DVD.
Oh, I can't wait.
Oh, it's so great. Keith, we could have made a whole film with just these outtakes. They're an hour long. But Keith says, you know, we were sitting there, a lot of scratching of heads trying to figure out Bert Burns, Bert Russell. Was this the same guy? He must have been a black guy. We couldn't figure it out, you know, and it's really funny how he describes it.
Maybe it was something like, for me, this is how I thought of it when I'm watching. I'm like, well, maybe he used this name, and if he failed under that name, he could still succeed under this name. You know, you can just keep reinventing yourself.
Yeah.
But he succeeded all the way, no matter what name he used.
Well, he certainly diluted his name recognition with all these names. You know, it's bad enough that no one knows who he is. And then some people might know him as Burt Burns mm-hmm. and Russell Bird and Burt Russell. And so it's, having to piece this story together, we also kind of had to, recreate an identity that was scattered with all these different names.
Well, what's great is, you're mentioning Keith Richards and Paul McCartney's in here, and Little Steven narrates it. And, just all these guys, they know who your dad is.
Yeah.
Which is, that's so cool. Yeah. I mean, Mick Jagger doesn't know who my dad is, but he knows Burt Burns. It's so great.
He does.
And, the trajectory after he had, your dad had the, rheumatic fever and he gets better. He comes home from the hospital, but he can't be active really. Right. He's not allowed to be. Can't put stress on his heart.
Yeah, he never went back to school again after he got that rheumatic fever as mm-hmm. a young teen. And the family moved him to Florida, to Miami, because they thought the weather would be better. But then he didn't like it there, so he came back to New York. And, instead of sort of like crawling up into a ball like some people might do when they find out that they have a death sentence, he just decided to live his life and started dancing in Harlem Mambo nightclubs and, goes to Cuba before the revolution. I mean, we go through a lot of this in the film.
Yes.
But, it really was, he didn't waste any time. He just like tore straight into life.
But he wasn't really from a musical family.
No, but they bought the piano for him because he was home all the time. And so
that was something for him to do.
That was something.
So they wanted to nurture some type of a talent or some type of fun for him. And that was the best thing they could have ever done.
Yeah. He just played like hours of classical piano. And I think that really informed his songwriting later with the classical upbringing,
But, and what I like about this story too is he, like I said, not from a musical family. Your dad made his own way in this business.
Yeah.
He figured it out, how to do it, and he did it.
Yeah.
And it's like really a celebration. It's really a success story of what your dad did.
Yeah. And it's very inspirational on many levels. Mm-hmm. And one of the most inspiring for me personally is he was a late starter. He didn't have his first hit record till he was 31 years old, which is pretty long in the tooth for rock and roll back in those days.
And can you imagine that now, someone 31 trying to break into the music business? I mean, that would almost be impossible now.
Right.
I mean, unless we're a genius, and your dad's called a genius many times in this film. But yeah, I can't imagine.
Yeah, no, it was, his family thought he was insane going into the business, at that point.
Yeah.
And really it was as soon as he got that first job, that first $50 a week songwriting gig, he had a hit. And it was A Little Bit of Soap by the Jarmels, a doo-wop number that was a pretty good size hit. And then from there, it just was like this meteoric, star shooting across the sky of New York City for 7 straight years.
Well, since you brought up A Little Bit of Soap, and I have that on the list, let's hear a little bit of A Little Bit of Soap.
A little bit of soap will wash away your lipstick on my face, but a little bit of soap will never, 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 ever erase the pain in my heart and my eyes as I go through the lonely hills. A little bit of soap will wash away my tears. Mm, a little bit of soul.
Love it. Awesome.
Love it. Let me ask you, a little bit about Burt Burns. Brett, what was your background before you made this film? How did you make a living? What were you up to?
Yeah, I did everything I could to get out of the entertainment industry because my mother, picked up after my dad passed away in 1967 and had a whole, sort of 15-year run in the record business of her own. And she was one of the great women in the history of the record business.
So she learned about the record business just from being married to your dad.
Right.
And then he passes and she kind of picks up the family mantle and runs with it.
Yeah, I mean, she had...
That's pretty incredible.
It's incredible. She was a go-go dancer in the Peppermint Lounge. That was her background. Mm-hmm. And so when he passed away and there was a record label and all the artists left the label, Van Morrison leaves, Neil Diamond leaves, as they would because they were there for my dad, certainly not for a 24-year-old widow with three babies in the crib. So she really picked up and had an amazing run. She discovered a singer-songwriter by the name of Paul Davis, who had a bunch of hits in the 70s.
Oh, I Go Crazy.
That's right, yeah. And Cool Night. And he just Paul was like an uncle to my sister and brother and I, growing up, to all of my siblings. And she discovered Peebo Bryson.
Oh, wow.
And had hits with a band called Brick, which had a big hit called Daz. So my mom was the star of our lives growing up, and I didn't know very much about my dad, just the little bit that she would tell me and my siblings along the way. And so, you know, she moved us to Atlanta after he died in New York City, and we grew up in the oblivion of the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, and it was really wonderful. And I went to college in Virginia, and I joined the Army. I served in the Israeli paratroopers. Again, because my dad was a Zionist and loved Israel and wanted to fight in the Six-Day War, but he had brown-eyed girl going up the charts in 67, and then he died in 67. Yeah. So, you know, I did a lot of things in my life to sort of like please the father that I never knew, and that was one of them. And I came back from Israel one weekend, and I had been in an ambush in South Lebanon with the Hezbollah. It was one of the biggest firefights I'd been in the whole time I was in the Army. And then I come home, and that weekend, my sister says, "We're getting the copyrights back." And I didn't know what that meant, but the songs revert back to the heirs.
And how old are you at that point?
I was in my mid-20s, like 24. And it was really a wake-up call for us. We realized, okay, we have this legacy that we're going to have to take care of and nurture. And it was Paul Davis who said, "Ben David," he was from Mississippi, and he talked a real Southern accent. He said, it was my middle name, Ben David. He said, "You know, this legacy is yours, and only you are really going to be able to champion your father." Mm-hmm. And, you know, he told me at a very young age that I was going to go on this journey. And I didn't believe him when he said it, but it really did take years for us to realize, first of all, the depth of the legacy. We discovered the hundreds of songs that he wrote and produced. Many of them I found on eBay from record sellers all over the world when eBay came along. And then I started to, you know, meet his friends. My dad would tell my mother, "My children will know me through my music." It was a sort of a mantra of his. He knew he was going to die young, and so he would say this. And I never really knew what that meant. What does "Twist and Shout" and "Hang on, Sloopy" and "I Want Candy" and, you know, the sort of those pop songs, what do they tell you about a person?
Now, right now, people listening, their head just exploded because they're like, "What? Wait a minute. Those are Burt Burns songs? I know those. I know all those songs."
Yeah. Yeah. He wrote at least a dozen classics, and he produced probably another dozen more songs that if only he had only produced under the Boardwalk and Brown Eyed Girl and songs like that, I think his legacy still would have been, you know, worthy of a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. But the fact that he wrote songs like "Hang on, Sloopy" and "Tell Him" and "Cry to Me" and "Everybody Needs Somebody to Love" and "Peace of My Heart." And I mean, my goodness, the songs just, they go on and on. Like, it really was a discovery of the depth of the legacy and then of how obscure he was. And that was what really motivated me and made me go into the entertainment industry in the end, because I thought, okay, the only way we're going to get him recognized for his musical legacy is to tell this harrowing life story that we discovered.
I'm gonna play a song that you just brought up, a song by the Exciters. And again, when I watched this movie, I just kept saying, "He wrote that one?" And you know, and he wrote this one? And I mean, because a lot of the songs, they're not similar. "Hang on, Sloopy" is not like "Tell Him."
Right.
So let's hear a little bit of "Tell Him" by the Exciters. Now, Brett, I don't know anything about publishing and money and all that kind of stuff, but I think this song was on the Big Chill soundtrack.
Yes, it was.
That's got to be something good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
I mean,
good.
That was like one of the biggest selling soundtracks, I think, until maybe The Bodyguard came out. I mean, that's how I know this song. I know it from seeing The Big Chill when I was in high school and owning The Big Chill soundtrack. That's how I know this song. Right. Now, did I read the liner notes and read the name Burt Burns? I did not. I didn't even know who sang. I wouldn't even have known the artist who sang that, but I knew the song.
Yeah, it's amazing how many of my dad's songs are actually known, not because they were hits in their time, but because they were either covered by great artists like Janis Joplin covering a couple of the biggest songs, you know, the Blues Brothers covering Everybody Needs Somebody, you know, those kind of things were really, and then these movie licenses, like when you have, you know, use like Cry to Me and Dirty Dancing or Tell Him and The Big Chill, the songs just become even bigger than you could have imagined. Yeah. And so I that's been a blessing.
You know, the word iconic is thrown around so much, but iconic. These are iconic songs. So I just want to know that, because you always hear about all these bad publishing deals and everything. Your dad has left the family. He had good deals. Did he have good deals with all this stuff?
He made very bad deals at first.
Sure, but all those music people do it. That's all the time. But I mean, you come out through the other end, and you guys are okay.
Yeah, his songs have taken very good care of us. There's a song called "I'll Take Good Care of You" that you know, really we identify with, because his songs have taken extraordinarily good care of the family all these years. But when he started, he got robbed just like everybody else. Yeah. I mean, he got smart quickly. And, you know, when he started his own music publishing company and his own record labels, because his belief is like first hands on the money, get paid at the sources. He would tell all of his friends and give them these lessons that he learned the hard way himself. But we've also had to fight along the ways as the heirs to recapture rights and enforce the rights. It's not the fun part of music publishing or the entertainment business.
But now you guys hold it. You guys have it.
Yeah, we hold it.
No one can take it away from you.
No, eventually they'll go into the public domain, but even then they'll live in our hearts and in my children's hearts forever.
And what about gold records and stuff? Do you guys have those awards? Do you have things like that as keepsakes?
We have some old BMI awards of his that are like wooden plaques, old fashioned things like that. But, you know, most of the things that he had got lost along the way. I mean, like, we made this movie without a single frame of video of my dad, because none exists in the world. And the reason for that is because the day that he died, we were moving into a house in New Jersey, and we were in a hotel room across from the Dakota. And my mother never went back to the hotel room after he passed. But in that room were boxes of home movies and the things that really matter when you're moving.
So what do you think? Did the people at the hotel just throw those away? Or
thrown out on the street. Yeah, she never went back, and they just figured it was abandoned junk, and it just went straight.
I mean, I understand that she wouldn't be able to go back into the hotel. I understand, because you're not thinking that, oh, I got to get that stuff. You're just not thinking that.
Yeah, it's really a tragic part of the story is, you know, so much of the legacy was lost. But really, when you look at it, the music was not. And we recaptured it, and we, you know, clawed rights back, and we would find records again, like on eBay. And, you know, 40 of the songs in the documentary are songs like this that we discovered, B-sides of some obscure record that were just classic Burt Burns songs.
Now, I don't know if I have it here, but here's one that you wanted me to play. Am I Grooving You by Freddie Scott?
Yeah.
Now, why does this mean so much to you? Why was this? Because when I ask you, hey, are there any songs you'd want to hear? This was one of the first ones you said.
Yeah, well, it's a song that features heavily in the film, and it's one of my favorites. Freddie Scott is really one of the great unsung heroes of that whole time and place, and my dad worked with him right at the end up until the very end, and I just love the entire Freddie Scott output. But Am I Grooving You is a record that, you know, Keith Richards and Ron Wood, they covered that song on a solo album. I mean, it's like a kind of a deep, cool R&B soul record that was actually made, and this is something not many people know, right after my dad died. My mother brought these guys into the studio, all the same people that he worked with, and just said, make this record. And they made the record as if it was a Burt Burns production. And his name is on as a producer, even though it was recorded in 1968.
So, Am I Grooving You? This is a labor of love for your dad.
Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
When I touch you, baby, am I grooving you? If I love you too much, baby, am I grooving you? Do you
by your side. Let me love you. Let me try to keep you satisfied. 'Cause I'd like to hear you say,
you know you make me want to shine.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great in the headphones.
It's amazing. Yeah, that's Sissy Houston and the girls singing background vocals. Sissy's a star of the film. You know, all the same studio musicians were there for that session. It's really one of the masterpieces.
Yeah, I only named Little Steven, Keith Richards, and Paul McCartney, but Van Morrison's in it, Ronald Isley, Solomon Burke. I didn't know Solomon Burke was still around. He looks amazing.
Yeah, he passed shortly after we did that interview. So yeah,
he looks great in the film.
Yeah, the old lion was roaring in his throne. He made us get him a throne. It was part of the rider.
And really,
yeah,
the chair he's sitting in. That's what he wanted. That
he wanted 24 red roses and a throne.
And he sings. He just breaks into song at one point, and it's wonderful.
It really is amazing. I mean, you know, getting Solomon Burke and these people in the film, again, many of them have passed since the film was made. You know, it was one of the motivating things for me is I went to see Freddie Scott, who we just heard at an oldies concert in Long Island with Wazzle. Wazzle's the, you know, we'll talk about
Wazzle. Yeah, we'll talk about Wazzle. This guy's a character.
Yeah, old kind of gangster. But I went and saw Freddie Scott, and I was just so excited to meet Freddie Scott. And I was telling him I was thinking about making a documentary about my dad, and I hoped that he would let me interview him. And he was like, yes, just let me know when. And then Freddie dropped dead. And that motivated me to just start shooting interviews with these people because I was afraid I was going to lose them. And, of course, we have lost a lot of them since, but most are still with us, thankfully.
Brenda Reed from the Exciters is in it. She said, your dad, he's cool. He was the White Soul brother. Yeah. And Sissy Houston's in it, Benny King. There were no racial boundaries in the studio with your dad.
No.
These people loved your dad, and your dad obviously loved these artists. I mean, that must have been... you know, because I don't know what it's like to be black now, let alone then, but they must have felt like this was a safe haven for them in the studio and to create. And there's a part in the film where some of them are invited up to your dad's penthouse. Right. Maybe it was Solomon Burke. Maybe it was him. And he's just like, I'm never in a penthouse. I was never in a white person's apartment.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah,
I love that part of the film. I love that all these people loved your dad and he loved them. And it was really a nice mutual respect. It really comes through.
Yeah, it was a magic time in America, you know. And I think that with my dad in particular, you know, he almost only worked with African-American artists and bands. I mean, it was an exception if the band was white or if the singer was white. His sole love and focus was really R&B. And soul music, really contemporary uptown soul, which he and some other people really invented that whole sound right there in New York in the early 60s. So, you know, the fact that he would have them all up to the penthouse, I think was part of what made the magic happen because they felt comfortable with him, you know, when they would just sit up all night drinking and cooking out and smoking weed and, you know, whatever else might have been going on up there. And then when he went in the studio the next day, you know, they were friends and it was already.
And I'm sure other people that lived in that building did not like that.
Yeah.
Probably not.
I bet.
But I like that because I create a backstory for myself that where Burt Burns is like, well, I don't give a fuck what the rest of these people think. These are my friends and they're coming up to my penthouse.
Yeah. Now he danced to the beat of his own drum. That's what Benny King said. And like, to hell with you. That was his attitude. And that got him into some trouble too.
Yeah. Now, did you conduct these interviews? Were you here for all these interviews?
I conducted every one of these interviews, and it was terrifying for a first-time filmmaker to sit in front of anybody, much less some of these giants. I mean, it was really...
So you sat there with Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
How much time does a Paul McCartney give a Brett Burns? Does he say, I can give you 20 minutes? Does he say whatever you need?
I felt like with Paul in particular and, you know, with Keith and these superstars, you know, that I wanted to, you know, make the most of the time that I had. So we would...
You were being considerate of their time.
Yeah. And I felt like it was, you know, like a half an hour was plenty of time to get through. Although like with some of the interviews, like with Carmine De Noia, that was like a 3-hour interview. And, you know, my mother was a 3-hour interview.
Yeah.
And, you know, but with guys like Keith Richards and Paul and Van Morrison, They were pretty quick, maybe half hour, 45 minutes. Yeah. And the amazing thing about those guys is they're so pro. They just come in prepared. I feel like I asked Paul McCartney one question and he was just off and he interviewed himself basically. And it was amazing just to sit there across from him and like willing him to just keep going.
Let's, since I brought up Paul McCartney, let's hear Twist and Shout by the Isley Brothers. And then we'll talk a little bit about how Phil Spector had this song and didn't do it justice. Okay. But we'll listen to the Isley Brothers, and then we'll listen to what the Beatles did with it. That's the Isleys, and let's go right into the Beatles.
Well, shake it up, baby, now.
Shake it up, baby.
Twist and shout.
Twist and shout.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, baby, now.
Come on, baby.
Come on and work it on out.
Work it on out,
baby.
Probably the first time I ever heard this song was probably the Beatles version. And I like in the interview, Paul even says people thought that the Beatles wrote that song.
Sure.
And that was a co-write, because your dad would write songs by himself, but then he would write with other people too.
Right.
So let's give Phil Medley.
Phil Medley.
I don't know who Phil Medley is.
Phil Medley had one hit and it was Twist and Shout. And my dad was really remarkable as a songwriter because in those days, almost every songwriter had a writing partner. Lieber had Stoller and Goffin had King and Barry Mann had Cynthia Weil. And Burt Burns was the only one of these songwriters that really wrote by himself lyrics and music, or he would write with everyone from my mother to Van Morrison. You know, he has maybe, I don't know, like 50 or 60 co-writers on the copyright search. So
now someone who was not a nice person might try to get all of the pie for himself, but that doesn't seem like that was what your dad was about. If he was writing a song and someone helped significantly, or even maybe just a little bit, but enough to where he thought that was an important integral part of the song, then they would get a co-writing credit. That's what came across to me.
That's exactly true. He was so fair that if there was one person in the room, he split it 50-50. Or if there were three, you know, it was a third, a third, and a third. It was like, so he, he never really took more of a song or less of a song. He just drew the line down the middle. Phil Medley, the story goes, there were two other guys in the room and they both went to get coffee and pizza and they came back and the song was written and Phil Medley got half the credit of a song that nobody knew it was going to become one of the greatest songs in rock and roll history. But, that's kind of how it worked back then.
Now, were those other two guys there to help write it also?
Yeah. Yeah, they were just there to write songs together, and they were like, "Let's go, we'll go get some cigarettes, some coffee," and then they came back, and the song was already done.
They're not going to write a hit while we're gone,
right?
We'll be fine.
Yeah, said, never go get the donuts.
The worst songwriting story that I've ever read is the song "I Want to Know What Love Is" by Foreigner.
Yeah,
everyone knows that song. I guess Mick Jones started writing it, and he asked Lou Gramm, the singer, to help him write it, and together they finished it, and then they would always discuss at the end how much percentage. And Lou said, I think 50-50, and Mick said, I think 95-5, meaning Mick won in 95%. And Lou said, just take it, because he was so pissed off, never thinking that what this song would do. So, Lou doesn't even have songwriting credit on it.
No, there's some unfortunate stories there in the Foreigner story.
Yeah, yes. I know, it sucks.
Does, but not with my dad. I couldn't find anybody who said he robbed me. There were some whispers of the mob played a huge part in my father's story, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But you know, no one ever said that Burt Burns robbed them. I think, you know, Neil Diamond feels like my dad didn't pay him properly. And I don't know if Van Morrison also felt that way. My mother robbed Neil Diamond and Van Morrison blind, you know, after my father died.
They were both on, their first albums both came out on Bang Records, which was your dad's label. And I love that in the film you use the Bang logo throughout the film. I mean, the font, if whatever you want to call it. And I remember that Bang logo because my brother had, it was a double disc Neil Diamond compilation. And those first two Neil Diamond albums, I'm a big Neil Diamond fan.
Me too.
And I was waiting. I'm like, hey, I wonder if Neil Diamond's going to be interviewed in the film. And then, well, we find out that your dad and Neil had a falling out.
Yeah.
But so you didn't try to, did you try to get Neil?
Oh, yes. We tried very hard. We got about 99% of the people we hoped to get into the film. The only two that got away were Jimmy Page and Neil Diamond. And Jimmy Page kept saying, I want to be in this film. I'm going to try to schedule it. And, you know, he's constantly remastering Led Zeppelin albums, but he played a very,
and I'm constantly rebuying those.
So. Me too. And, so we never were able to wrangle Jimmy, but with Neil, it's trickier because, you know, as we tell in the film, I mean, he came within an inch of his life, I think, because, you know, my dad used too heavy of a hand, I would argue, even as his son, in the negotiations by bringing the head of the Genovese mob into the negotiation. I mean, that's like very heavy hand.
Right.
I don't know, maybe he never reconciled with what happened there.
That's sad because, I mean, he's in his 70s and, you know, it's not like he just disappeared.
No.
He had fantastic success.
Yeah. And I got a letter from him a number of years ago when I was just getting started. I wrote a letter to Neil Diamond, kind of almost like a fan mail letter. And months went by, never heard back. And then all of a sudden I get a letter from him and I treasure it to this day. And he says, you know, if it wasn't for your father, I probably wouldn't have made it. And I held him in a state of awe during my time at Bang Records. And I was there in the office when he named you his son, Brett. And, you know, I was holding out hope that he might give us the interview, but you know, who knows? There could have been other issues. I mean, Neil doesn't do these things. That's the other thing you have to stop
he
and say yourself.
He doesn't do stuff.
He doesn't do documentaries. And, you know, so it's understandable, I guess. And the other thing that was remarkable, too, is we found a lot of great archival footage of Neil and we put it in the film. And then when we got our date with South by Southwest and we were racing to finish the film and we were not getting an answer from Neil about the interview and whether we could even use that stuff in the film, we took it all out. And what it did was made a better film. And this is not just spin. It kept the end of the story focused on my dad's
legacy.
That's
interesting.
And not on the Neil Diamond stuff, which as much as I love those songs, those are not Burt Burns songs.
No.
Those are Jeff Berry and Ellie Greenwich and Neil Diamond records that my dad worked like a madman to get them, you know, up the charts. But they weren't that R&B and that soul music my father.
And Jeff and Ellie produced those albums too. So it was just, those were just released on your dad's label.
Correct.
He would have been maybe executive type producer, just overseeing what was going on.
He was in there clapping hands and singing background vocals and, you know, but where he really came in is, you know, when the records were pressed and he was working radio, because my dad did everything. He wrote the songs, he produced the records, he went to the DJs. You know, I mean, there wasn't anything he didn't do along the way of records creation.
Two nice Jewish boys. You think they'd work it out?
You think they would? Yeah. You know, as Neil Diamond put out a Bang Records retrospective.
Yeah.
All of the songs that he recorded for Bang Records a couple years ago. And he wrote the liner notes himself. And my phone didn't stop ringing when it came out because people were saying, did you notice that Neil Diamond wrote the liner notes to his Bang Records?
See, I'm going to have to pull that out when I get home and read those liner notes because I liner notes, you read them once and then I haven't read that since it came out.
Yeah, well, they're great liner notes. The only part that's missing is Burt Burns. There's just no mention of Burt Burns, the guy
it's his label.
It's his label, yeah. Again, you can read between the lines and again, I can't stand in judgment if somebody had, you know, threatened me with the level that my father had threatened Neil. Yeah. I might also feel,
We did get Van Morrison, who I thought would be super tricky and hard to deal with, but he was great.
He was great. And, you know, over the years growing up, I had heard and read things that were both complimentary about my dad coming from Van and some things that were maybe less so. And so it was really fantastic to meet him and speak with him. And I think, you know, my theory is that Van didn't know about all the things my father was going through with his health issues and with his battles with Atlantic Records and
probably,
the mob.
Yeah, probably not. Now that I'm thinking about what was in his answers and stuff in the film, he probably didn't.
Yeah, he didn't know. And so I think that, you know, this, what the New York Times called the Burns Boomlet, which is this musical that's going to Broadway and Joel Selvin's epic biography and now this film, I think that Van and a lot of people have learned a lot about Bert, that things that they didn't know, and it might have helped give them a new sense of their own history and some catharsis as well.
Very cool. I want to play Brown Eyed Girl. Your dad produced this.
He did. And it was a brown skin girl when it came into the studio, and they changed the words to Brown Eyed Girl because it was never going to get on the radio as Brown Skin Girl in 1967.
And yet 4 years later, Brown Sugar gets on the radio.
Right. A lot changed in the couple of years.
A lot changed. Well, Brown Eyed Girl is that's just so much better.
It's so much better. Yeah.
This is like a staple at my house because my wife has brown eyes and my youngest daughter has brown eyes. So this is a great song. And I like in the movie, in the doc, the guitar player asks if he can play bass.
Yeah.
And they say, what are you talking about? You're one of the best guitar players ever. We don't want you to play bass. And then he says, "What I'm going to play bass like no one's ever played bass before."
Yeah.
And he plays it with a pick.
Right.
All right. Let's hear this. Everyone knows this song. Come on.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rains came down in the hollow, playing a new game, laughing and running, hey, hey, skipping and a jumping in the misty morning fog with all our hearts that thumping, and you, my brown eyed girl, and you, my brown eyed girl.
I wish that Van would have made another album on Bang, because what's it called? Blowing My Mind?
Yeah.
Such a great album.
Yeah. No, that was also a big source of conflict too, because my father, you know, was told Van he was just making singles, and then Van goes back to England and comes back and there's an album, which he had no idea that Bert was making an album, mm-hmm. and calling it Blowing Your Mind, which, you know, Van was not into psychedelics, so I don't think so. It really wasn't his, you know, kind of thing. But in the end, the record is a stone classic.
It's so great. See, this is what I'm glad. I'm glad that Van, because you're naming a bunch of things that Van might have had some problems with, and yet he agreed to do the documentary, which is great.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, Wazzle taught me a lot of things. Carmine DeNoia's nickname is Wazzle. He said, you got to crawl before you walk. And so I took that to heart, and we started interviewing people that we thought we could get, like, mm-hmm. you know, Sissy Houston and Benny King and people who, although they were giants, they were, you know, they're the heroes of people like Paul McCartney and Keith
yes.
Richards and Van. And so when a first time filmmaker with no distributor and, you know, nobody, nothing kind of like going on, but, you know, but a rough cut that had all these legends and these people that those guys loved,
right.
I think it made it easier for them to come on board, you know, when they did.
I love how music like ping pongs across the pond, like rhythm and blues. That's what Jagger and Richards and Lennon and McCartney loved, and that's what they looked up to. And then, you know, later bands in the States looked up to the British invasion. It's just like, it just keeps going back and forth. But it all starts with the music that your dad produced.
Yeah. And he was, as we'd say in the film, he was the first and really almost the only American producer to go to England during the British invasion, because he sees all these, like, you know, checks coming in from England for these songs that he had written,
yeah.
covered by these British bands. And so he was invited by Decca Records to go and produce anyone he wanted to. And that's how he discovered Van and Lulu. And he passed on Tom Jones. This is a story we couldn't tell in the film, but my dad didn't see the potential in Tom Jones, and he passed on working with him. And then 6 months later, when Tom had his big hit with It's Not Unusual, my dad walked up to him in a restaurant and shook his hand and said, you can't pick them all. Tom Jones tells that story because Burt Burns was his Dick Rowe, the guy who passed on the Beatles.
This is not to step on your story, but I just recently heard a story about Mike Campbell from the Heartbreakers. He wrote Boys of Summer, and he presented that to Tom, and Tom just didn't like it. He didn't get it. And so he Then he took it to Don Henley, and Don like recorded it immediately. He's like, this is it. Let's do it. Let's finish it and record it immediately. And then when Tom heard it on the radio, he did tell Mike, yeah, that was a mistake.
Awesome. Oh my God. Love Tom Petty. Tom Petty covered a Burt Burns song. He covered Cry to Me with Mud Crutch. That's one of those little sort of trivia, Burt Burns trivias.
I have those Mud Crutch albums.
Yeah.
So see, this was
Tom's father's favorite song. And so he recorded Cry to Me for his dad.
See, these people, you're going to start going on a deep dive of Burt Burns.
Yeah.
Hopefully after you hear this, but then especially after you watch this documentary, which comes out June 1st.
It comes out on DVD June 1st because it's been making the rounds for 2 years since South by Southwest world premiere 2 years ago. And then we had a U.S. theatrical mm-hmm. release through Abramarama. And Apple Music and Jimmy Iovine came in and gave us a global digital mm-hmm. release. And so the fact that it's coming on DVD right now is really special because I think most of our audience are people who want a DVD yeah. still in this day and age when CDs and DVDs are kind of like going the way of the 8-track tape. But
is it weird to pick that? You have a DVD in front of it. Is it weird to hold that in your hand? Like, you know, all the blood, sweat and tears and hard work that went into that and you're holding it right there in your hand.
I take it everywhere I go. It just inspires me. It's so great looking and I just love it.
The artwork, everything about it. There's a really cool picture of your dad. So you got a smoke in his mouth there?
Every picture of him has a cigarette in his mouth. He chain smoked filterless.
Now see, that's another thing that's crazy to me is he has a heart condition. That doesn't stop him from smoking.
No, back then it was like, right, Chesterfields that cigarettes doctors recommend yeah. most. I mean, I think he knew potentially that this couldn't be good for him, but yeah. I mean, he was just like had this nervous energy and, you know, mm-hmm. he was this kind of like long hair and he was sweating all the time, kind of like I am now. And, you know, the cigarette was just sort of a part of his, I think, his persona, you know, it just yeah. was in every single picture we found in him. He's got that cigarette.
Well, it's, you know, when I see, you know, David Bowie's gone and every picture I see of David Bowie, he's got a cigarette in his hand or in his mouth too. And it's just, I've never smoked, so
it's not my thing.
But I always, you know, since he had a heart condition, I was like, the smoking.
Yeah, no. And he was seeing Dr. DeBicke, the great heart surgeon who was trying to get the heart bypass surgery. Mm-hmm. He was trying to build up, you know, the courage to actually go under the knife. But as he said, it was like going to the moon back then to have that surgery or just as likely to die.
Yeah, it says like, it was, I think Steve Van Zandt says it's like science fiction back then to yeah. open up your chest and go in there.
Can you imagine? No, he was going to do it. He was seeing this famous psychiatrist who had only saw Holocaust survivors because mm-hmm. I guess he was also grappling with the issues of death because, you know, he was having cardiac events. And there's a story we tell in the extras that Brooks Arthur, my father's engineer, the great Brooks Arthur, says that they were driving down the freeway one day in the Jaguar convertible 12-cylinder and my father just pulls over and pulls out a paper bag and starts breathing the Valsalvo method. And you know, it was, you know, so he would have these kind of
yeah.
Cardiac events and not everybody knew. In fact, most people didn't know that he was sick. He didn't sort of let people in on that. He acted like he was normal.
Well, I think people that do that, probably they're afraid that record companies or artists would think that they're a liability. And so they might not want to work with you if they think that you're not feeling well or sick.
Yeah.
So
and he was kind of like this tough guy too. Mm-hmm. He was very macho. Like, you know, I always call him the fighting Jew. You know, he watched the Holocaust as a kid and, you know, he would say never again. And I think that fighting Jew is kind of part of this guy who, you know, broke a few eggs making omelets yeah. as Joel Selvin wrote in his book.
Well, I think he met the right woman then because your mom, and I hope this term is okay with you, she comes across as a ballsy broad to me.
That's the best way I've heard it in a long time. That's who she is.
And she, I mean, those two together must have been a force to reckon with. I love the story. She's in his apartment. He just turns the light out and kisses her. And she's like, oh, I'm in love.
Yeah, right.
So great.
Yeah, no. And it happened all very fast with them. You know, a couple of dates and she was knocked up. This is not something that we talk about in the film because yeah. she did not want me to. Ironically, we go into this.
Isn't that funny? All the stuff she says that she was a go-go dancer, not a stripper, but right. a go-go dancer in clubs frequented by the mob and all that stuff's okay. But the act that you're in love and you get pregnant, that's a no-no.
Right, right.
It's so funny.
He did the right thing and he got married and had two more kids in the next 2 years. And, you know, I think they were genuinely in love, but she was tough. And, you know, I've heard stories that, you know, she would drive him crazy. And, you know, like he had this Great Dane dog and the dog would constantly like hit her pregnant belly and you know, with his tail. And she's like, you got to get the dog out of here. It's either me or the dog. And he said, okay, you know, and he moved out with the dog. Yeah, so that was my dad. He was not going to be pushed around by anybody, including my mother.
I think there's another part in the film where she said something to him, maybe in a meeting or something. And then he was mad at her, but then he gave her a kiss and told her that she was right.
Yeah.
Something like that. I'm paraphrasing the whole thing.
Yeah. Somebody said she was a great first lady. And I think that's a, you know, really good way to put it. She was tough. And so, you know, he might've crumbled at that moment of truth when his partners at Atlantic said, you know, we want to, you know, take a commanding control in the record label. And she, as we tell in the film, she stood up and said, hell no. And, you know, it was sort of, that was the beginning of the end of that relationship.
Yeah.
But, you know, that is my mom. Like, she was the toughest man or woman I ever met in my life.
Well, again, I'm so glad that, you had told me before we started recording that your mom passed away not too long ago, but she was able to go to the screening, see it on the big screen and get a nice round of applause from the audience. So that's really great.
Yeah. My mom, I always joke, but it's not a joke. She was the hardest interview for me to get. I mean, with all these icons of rock and roll and rhythm and blues, my mom held out very long and, you know, made me really suffer to get her to sit for that interview. And when she did, it was like just raging bull the whole time.
And was it because she was afraid to talk about things that would make her emotional? Is that what it was, you think? Or you know, obviously she didn't want to, it wasn't just like, I don't want to be in your stupid film. She probably didn't want to talk about these things. Maybe they bring up too many memories.
Yeah. I think it was a combination of that. And, you know, she always accused me of making too much out of the mob thing, you know, and one of the taglines of the film is music meets the mob. And, you know, it's mostly about the music and the music. It's what's important to me. But again, we realized, and you know, everybody loves a great mob story.
Yeah.
And this is, one of the best ones I've ever come across.
Your dad hung around with some wise guys.
Yeah.
But your dad doesn't come across as a shady character in this, but some of his friends were, but they didn't help sell his records or anything like that. They just seemed like they liked the music. They liked your dad. They liked his company. And so they just hang out together.
Yeah.
That's how it comes across to me.
But
they were also, you know, they were also, if anyone does anything to Bert, there's going to be some trouble with those type of guys.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the mob, we learned, were everywhere back in those days
I'm sure they were.
Yeah, you couldn't do business without doing business with the mob.
Yeah.
That's how it was with the DJs, with the labels, everybody. But nobody was as mobbed up as my dad. And, you know, I say that, you know, kind of like thinking, all right, you know, but it's true. You know, he was on the level of Frank Sinatra. And it was because, you know, he grew up on the mean streets of the Bronx and he was comfortable with those guys.
Yeah.
And he had just enormous charisma. He was like a character, had the kind of charisma of a rock star. And so those mob guys were attracted to him too.
Yeah.
And I think he liked them. And so, you know, he ran around everywhere with Carmine DeNoia, the star of our film.
Yeah.
But there was a guy named Tommy Eboli.
And Carmine's Wazzle.
Carmine's Wazzle.
Why is it? Why? Where does Wazzle come from?
So Wazzle was a mispronunciation of Louis Armstrong's song "I'll Be Glad When You're Dead, You Rascal You."
And that's right. He says that at the beginning. Someone couldn't say it, so it came. He couldn't say it, so it came out Wazzle instead of Rascal.
Yeah, he mangles the English language. You know, we almost subtitled him so people in the middle of America could understand what he's saying, but we decided not to do that. But my dad ran around with Wazzle everywhere. But the relationship with Tommy Eboli was one that really happened more in the shadows. And on the boat, they had yachts berthed next to each other at the 79th Street Boat Basin. And so, you know, nobody really knew. You know, my dad had relationship like that with Tommy and with the Pagano brothers in Westchester and those kind of people who...
This is a Scorsese film. I'm telling you, when you watch this documentary, just imagine it then taken to the next level, and it's a Scorsese film, and it totally works. The story's fantastic. The characters, all the players, everything, the music, the best soundtrack ever.
We used to think, like, we got to find Martin Scorsese because he's got to make this movie. And, you know, Martin Scorsese's a busy guy. And so we just started making this documentary ourselves. Maybe he'll make the biopic one day. There'll be a...
it's fantastic. It is so good. I want to play a couple songs songs that we know, but we didn't know that they were Burt Burns songs. For example, I'm going to play the original of this song by the Strange Loves. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
It's a weird word. It looks like strangle gloves. It looks like a bunch of different things. And then you're going to know this song, and then I'll play the version that you know better. Talk about who that band is in a minute, but this is the version from 1982 by Bow Wow Wow. I didn't even know this was a cover when this came out.
Wow.
I know a guy who's tough but sweet. He's so fine, he can be beat.
They changed the gender. Love the guitar.
Yeah.
So that was released on the Bang label. And that was, there's four songwriters on this. There's Burt Burns. And then the three guys that make up the Strange Loves. Right. And tell who those guys are.
So that's Richard Goddard, Bob Feldman, and Jerry Goldstein, who were three songwriter producers, who wrote My Boyfriend's Back by the Angels and had a couple of other hits. And, they just sort of became this bogus British invasion act. Actually, they said they were from Australia, sheepherders from Australia, Miles, Niles, and Giles Strange, each of whom had different fathers, and the mother was out in the bush all the time. I mean, they made this whole shtick, and then it was the first hit on Bang Records, and the label that just started just shot out with like a giant record, and they discover the McCoys on the road and record a song called Hang on Sloopy with the McCoys, which was the second big hit on Bang Records.
So. We'll play that next. The Strange Loves was kind of a goof, right? They're just kind of, it was almost like Spinal Tap. They're just like, oh, let's pretend we're a band and we'll make a great song. We'll be a band.
Yeah.
They didn't play any instruments.
Nope.
They just bang drums.
Yeah, African hair drums. Yeah, wearing zebra skin jackets. I mean, it was hilarious.
And the one member, I can't say his last name, Richard
Goddard.
Goddard. Yeah. And he co-produced the first Marshall Crenshaw album, which is a fantastic album.
Oh, yeah. Those guys went on to have huge careers, after the Strange Loves. I mean, Richard Goddard was a partner in Sire Records with Seymour Stein. And now he runs a company called The Orchard. Orchard was a huge record distributor. Jerry Goldstein also had a number of hits with Sly and the Family Stone and War. And Bob Feldman also, wrote songs and kept going. So, yeah, those guys are amazing.
And these guys are all in the film. So I assume they're still alive. They all look fantastic.
They're all going strong.
They look great.
Yes.
I say the Strange Loves have to go out on tour. They have to go to Coachella next year.
Well, we're going to do a tribute concert. This is as if the Burt Burns boomlet's going to keep going. And we have this musical going to Broadway. There's a whole bunch of other things happening. But I'm going to do a tribute concert. And I'm going to ask all of our fans and all of our friends, this Bruce Springsteen and Bette Midler and all those guys to come and sing a Burt Burns song. But I want to get the Strange Loves up there with those African hair drums to do I Want Candy one more time.
So the musical that's going to happen is this like the Carole King musical or Jersey Boys? Even
it's closest to Jersey Boys. We've been developing it for 10 years in New York City. Musicals are hard to do. Mm-hmm. And it's a long story, but we were developed by the not-for-profit theater companies like New York Theater Workshop and The Village, where Rent was born. And we went New York Stage and Film and spent a summer at Vassar College, where Hamilton did their pre-off-Broadway work around the same time. And we went off Broadway in the summer of 2014, got a great review from the New York Times, called us gorgeously tuneful. And majority of theater critics also weighed in. And, Stephen Van Zandt and Paul Schaefer and guys like that joined us as producers going to Broadway.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then the film happened. And the film was and is has been such an enormous success that, 2 years later, we're still you know, about to release the DVD, and there's going to be international broadcast in the fall. So, but the musical is really the crown jewel of our efforts. And after the off-Broadway production, we're going to be taking it to Broadway in the next 18 months.
You're so busy that I am amazed that you even answered my email.
Oh, no. Are you kidding? This is fun. And when I was like, we really got dug into some of your podcasts and things, I really enjoyed
it. Oh, thank you so much. Okay, so hang on, Sloopy. This was written by Burt Russell.
Yeah.
And Wes Farrell.
Right.
And this is a band, the McCoys. And Rick Derringer is the lead singer and the guitarist. But he doesn't look at all like the Rick Derringer that we know, you know, later on down the road with Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. This is a completely different thing. Again, that's another thing about this documentary. I'm like, oh my God, yes, I forgot Rick Derringer was in the McCoys.
Yeah.
So let's listen to Hang On Sloopy.
Hang on, Sloopy. Sloopy, hang on. And everybody, yeah, tries to put my Sloopy down. Sloopy, I don't care what your daddy do, 'cause you know, Sloopy girl, I'm in love with you. And so I say,
When you're putting together this musical, how hard is it to choose the songs? I mean, there's ones that you know have to be in it, but then it must be hard to make those choices. What's not going to be in it?
Yeah, you know? Well, we really let my father's songs guide us, because mm-hmm. one of the things that distinguishes his body of work is the autobiographical nature of his music. He, more than any of the other songwriter at that time, really wrote his pathology into his songs. And so when you look at Peace of My Heart and Heart Be Still, those are the two last songs that he wrote in the end of his life. And, you know, he was writing about his heart. And so, you know, the Cry to Me, Cry Baby, these songs, I mean, his songs were very deep and, you know, very soulful. And I feel like they were more autobiographical. And so when we started to plot, you know, how we were going to tell this story, we really let the songs guide us. And so that's why the show is different from Jersey Boys and Carole King. It's like we are sort of transformative of a genre that's, you know, arguably there's too many of these jukebox musicals running around, but our show is very different. And that's how we got in the door with the not-for-profit companies in New York that would never let a jukebox musical, you know, anywhere near them. So, you know, the songs really, you know, our mandate was, you know, let the songs, whichever song works is going to go. And if we used to say, if Twist and Shout doesn't fit in the show, it's not going in there.
It's not going in the show.
But thankfully it did. I think we would have been convinced to keep it anyways.
Let's hear, I do want to play Peace of My Heart. I mean, there's been so many covers. I mean, Melissa Etheridge has sang it. Sammy Hagar has sang it. So I guess the original version is Irma Franklin, though.
Yeah.
That's Aretha's older sister.
That's right.
I didn't even know there was an Irma Franklin.
Yeah, no, she had this one hit. She had a couple other smaller hits, but this was her big hit. And, you know, when my father died, that was really the end of her career and many others as well. People yeah. told me, like, when he died, that was it. It was over. It was all done. So, you know, I think it was the end of an era in music, but it was also, you know, when my dad was gone, you know.
Yeah, he nurtured these people. And then without that father figure, if you want to say that, how did no one else want these artists, though?
I think it was, again, this sort of the era of the self-contained songwriter and artist was coming up. It was the Beatles. You know, like my dad said, these guys are going to be the end of people like me. Because they realized these kids have genius. They're going to be the end of songwriter producers like Jerry Ragavoy and Burt Burns and Lieber and Stoller. And these guys, they were all finished right around the time that my dad died. It just happened to be, I think, the end of an era. And only people like Carole King, who wrote and sang her songs, kind of kept going.
But then there were people like Burt Bacharach, who continued to write songs, and Carol Bayer Sager and people like that. So
there were of course exceptions, but for the most part, I think most of them folded up their tents at the end of this thing, and then Led Zeppelin and everybody else came along, and that was kind of the beginning of a whole new turn in rock and roll.
Well, let's give Irma some love, and then we'll play what is probably the most well-known version of the same song, but this is Peace of My Heart.
Didn't I make you feel like you were the only man? Didn't I give you everything that a woman possibly can?
Also, that was a co-write. He co-wrote that with,
Jerry Ragavoy.
So bad with name pronunciations. Jerry Ragavoy. He's in the film, and he just says, I showed this clip to my wife today. He said, Bert would play his guitar, play some funky stuff on his guitar, and I'd play some funky stuff on the keyboard. We would just write some funky stuff.
Right, yeah.
It's like this old Jewish guy getting funky. I loved it. It was he's so cute. Is he still with us?
No, he had a stroke.
I don't even want to ask anymore about who's here and who isn't.
No, most are here still with us, thankfully. But Jerry Ragavoy had a stroke during the interview at the Bitter End in New York City. And I walked into the cab. It took about 10 minutes to go just from the stage to the street, and gave him a kiss goodbye. I loved him very much. He was one of the people who stood in the gap for my dad. And went to the hospital and died 48 hours later.
That is a horrible story.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, my God.
Trying to keep this light and fun, but there's a lot of dark corners in this Burt Burns story.
Wow. All right. Here's Big Brother and the Holding Company. This will lift our spirits.
Yeah.
With Janis Joplin, Peace of My Heart. Now, this one was released after your dad passed, so he never heard this.
No. Jerry Ragavoy got to live to see Janis not only cover that song, but also Cry Baby, the great Garnet Mims classic soul record. Janis really just dug those Burt Burns, Jerry Ragavoy songs.
And this sold 500,000 copies, the single did.
Mm.
So...
Yeah, no, he never lived to see a lot of the biggest covers of his songs, with the Janis Joplin,
Jerry got to buy a new car, I think.
Yeah, Jerry.
to Janis.
Yeah, she covered a couple of other his songs as well. So Stay With Me, Baby was a song Jerry Ragavoy did. It was, I always used to say to him, that's the greatest song my father never wrote. But it was an R&B record straight out of the Burt Burns kind of canon. And, I think... Jerry would be the first to admit that my father taught him soul. Jerry taught my dad a lot of things too, but it was a real great relationship.
I do also want to say that there is a soundtrack for this movie. It's on vinyl and it's on digital download. It's past the CD. You can either be a cool hipster and get the vinyl, or you can just download it, be a kid. And I downloaded the whole thing. It's so great.
Yeah, Sony Legacy, which is the label that owns the Bang and Shout Masters, my father's two labels, did a remarkable job with the soundtrack, and I just can't thank them enough for what they've done for my dad.
And how does that happen when you're making it? Because a lot of times a documentary doesn't have a soundtrack. I mean, it might there's songs in the movie, but it might not have an official soundtrack. How did you guys go about getting Sony Legacy involved? Were they on board immediately, or did they want to see the film first? How does that work?
Gosh, that's a good question. Doug Morris, who is one of the stars of the film, one of the great record men of all time, was the chairman of Sony Music at the time that the film came out. I think now he's doing some other things. But Doug may have played a part in it. But I think the guys like John Jackson and the guys at Legacy, when we told them we were making this film, they said, well, we want to make a soundtrack. And they said, if we're lucky, we're going to put it on vinyl. And then, of course, it became this like double vinyl gatefold masterpiece. It's really the trophy that I, the greatest trophy we could have hoped for.
And you gave me one.
Yeah. I brought one for you. I wanted you to have a copy.
That is so nice. I appreciate it. What other song? I have a whole list of songs here that are from the soundtrack. Is there something in particular you would like me to play tonight?
Well, I always love to shine a light on some of the obscure songs because, we used to find these records on eBay and then play them on a record player and wonder, like, what are they going to sound like and what are they going to tell us about our dad? And there's a song called Show Me Your Monkey that we used to think, like, what does this song mean? What are they talking about? Is it some kind of sexual double entendre? Which, maybe it is, but it's a song that I love and, really features in both the film and the musical.
And this is Kenny Hamber.
Kenny Hamber, who I also adore. I met along the way. He never had any real big hits, but he's, had a very remarkable career in gospel music and... Yeah, this record, we're hoping that it becomes like a classic sort of, 50 years after the fact.
Okay, here we go. Show me your monkey.
Do you really love me? Then come on and take a chance. And show me you love me by the way that you dance.
Show me your monkey.
This is also a co-write, Burt Russell, and is it Mike Leander?
Yeah, great arranger from England that my dad worked with, just one of dozens and dozens of co-writes. And, you listen to that song and you think like, oh my God, I've never heard it before, but there's things about it that you sound familiar because that's Sissy Houston and the girls singing in the backgrounds. Yeah. And that's, that baritone sax that's buried in there, is the same guy, Artie Kaplan, that played the sax on so many of those sessions. So, it was the... It really was like these musicians, these people came together and made this music together and they collaborated. And like you said before, color barriers just were left at the door. And my dad, he was like real collaborative spirit. He would say to Sissy Houston, just sprinkle a little something on there. And she really wrote a lot of those vocal arrangements uncredited and probably unpaid in some respects over the years for that, but and not just for my dad, but for everybody from Backrack and on down, like she and... Dion and Dee Dee Warwick, they would sing those background vocals and she'd make it up as they went along is what we learned.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love the collaborative thing you're talking about because there was probably, everyone probably wanted to work with Burt Burns and Burt Burns probably wanted to work with everybody.
Yeah, he did. And he did work. And when you look at the sessionography in Joel Selvin's book, that a guy in England named Rob Hughes put together. It's just, you can't believe that this guy had such an extraordinary output in such a short time.
I love books like that. I love to read that minutia.
Yeah.
Just every little take number 7 and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I love it. Let's hear, and here's a band I don't know, so let's play. The band's called The Pussycats, and this is a song called You May Be Holding My Baby.
If you're out tonight holding someone tight, I wonder maybe if he's holding you so. Are the lights down low? You may be holding my baby.
Don't hold him.
Oh no.
Don't kiss him.
touching your lips with his fingertips.
Now, Steve Van Zandt, was it easy to get him on board to do the narration for the movie?
Yeah, I mean, it was easy. Nothing's ever easy, of course. But right. With Stevie, he's a fan.
He's my a music junkie.
Yeah, he knows this stuff better than I do. Mm-hmm. And you know, along the way, I was fortunate to meet him through a friend, John Luongo, great record man. And it was the beginning of a relationship. And I had, you know, I just knew that he was going to play a part in our lives. I wasn't really quite sure how, because when I cut the first edit of the film, I learned to be an editor over 10 years, which is amazing, because I can't even, like, you know, tie my shoe when it comes to technology, but I can edit in Final Cut. And so I had this edit, and I did it without a narrator, and I thought I was being really clever. And then my co-director and editor, Bob Sarles, who I can't talk enough about and really made this film something beyond my wildest dreams, he was the one that said, no, you need a narrator. You didn't get the whole story in the interviews. And so he took Joel Selvin's book and the audio book and sort of pulled narration from Joel's book. And it was really a brilliant move by Bob.
That is a good move.
And
good job, Bob.
Right. And when we were done and we sat around and we said, okay, who do we want to narrate this? And Stevie was like the first thought that came through my mind, because he's sort of, you know, he's not just a musicologist. He also has the voice of Burt Burns. He kind of brings that New York sort of character.
And he was on The Sopranos.
Yeah. So he brought a little Silvio.
He understands
Silvio,
the world, yeah.
Right. He brought a little of that Silvio Dante into the interview. And it was so amazing. It was almost a one-take narration session. He just sat there and with his dog in his lap and just
with
read
his dog in his lap.
Yeah, in his studio in New York. And he and his wife, Maureen, are working with us as producers on the Broadway show as well. So, you know, it was that I got that phone call from him, you know, saying, are you guys standing up? Are you sitting down? Your father is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And my sister and I jumped and like hit our heads on the ceiling, because that was the goal of this whole enterprise. So, like, how are we going to get our dad in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Well, you did it.
Yeah, it was Stevie, though, was he's like, he says, I'm a hard guy to say no to when I get something in my mind. And so he really made that happen.
Well, you know, rumor has it that Steve Van Zandt has a lot to do with who gets in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, not just Burt Burns, but other people too. He has a lot of say, a lot of pull.
I heard that he got all of those songwriters into the Hall of Fame a couple years ago when Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich and Barry and Cynthia and all these great songwriters got in. I believe that it was Steven Van Zandt that made that happen.
Well, I mean, they should be. I mean, look, without this, it's like a movie. Without a script, there's not a movie. Without songs, there's, you know, without the song written, there's not an artist singing it. So
Nobody understands that better than Steven Van Zandt.
Yeah. Now, did Steven Van Zandt help you get your Bruce Springsteen tickets?
No, because I learned a long time ago, like one time I made the mistake of asking Steven for some favor connected to Bruce. And he says, Steven Van Zandt does not do bar mitzvahs, weddings. And he goes through this whole list of things like for Bruce Springsteen. I was like, I'm sorry I asked.
Yeah.
And so it was actually the publicist for the musical.
Okay.
Rick Miramontes, the greatest publicist on Broadway, is Bruce Springsteen's publicist.
Okay,
so I called Rick. Yeah.
I didn't know if Steven maybe would say, hey, if you ever want to see Bruce on Broadway, let me know.
No, I get to see Bruce a lot because I always go to Steven's events. And every time I go to anything Stevie does, there's Bruce. He just shows up. They're best friends.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
I like when I hear stories like that, that they're not just on stage together. These guys are together.
They love each other. They're best buddies. And, you know, so I we thought about trying to get Bruce into the documentary. And that might have been when I asked Steven. But, you know, it was like we thought, let's make a music documentary like so many others. We'll have some performances. We'll have like icons talking mm-hmm. about Burt. But then when we realized, OK, we have too much story to tell in 90 minutes as it is. So there's going to be no performances and there's going to be no Bono or you know, like that kind right. of thing. Like it was only the people who were there in the story are going to be in this film. And
makes sense. That's what makes this work. It makes it authentic. It makes it real. I mean, it's like you said, it's the people who were there. So I believe it. Yeah. And all their stories are the same. You know what I mean? No one's like refuting something that someone else said. Everyone is saying the same thing, and praising your dad 100%, which is very cool.
Yeah, and it's a the film is a time capsule of New York and the music scene in that era, and I think it's the only documentary, if I'm not mistaken, that really has taken this time period and the subject matter on the way it has. And Bob Sarles, his wife Christina Keating, they're a filmmaking partnership, so I had like two for the price of one, these guys working, and Christina found all that great archival footage that's in the film.
And so how did you hook up with them? Did you know them from someone else? How does that work?
It was Joel Selvin, the who is a star of the film, who wrote the Burt Burns biography.
Oh, okay.
He said, you need to work with Bob Sarles. He's going to do for you what I did for you with the book. And, you know, I just kept hearing this for the longest period of time. And then finally we were set up for a blind date at some dinner, and there was Bob, and we were just off to the races from that point on.
Cause you have to get along.
Yeah, no, I love him. He's like a big brother to me. And, you know, like somebody said, great art sometimes is made in turmoil. I know my dad, you know, life sometimes represented that. And there were times where Bob and I would butt heads. But, you know, I really gave him a free hand also, the way my dad would do with his artists. Again, my father has always been this kind of, you know, example for me to follow. And so, you know, when I met Bob, I didn't just sit over his shoulder. I left him alone for most of it, part of a year. I'd come in and I'd look at cuts and we'd talk and, you know, so yeah, I mean, people say, how does a first time filmmaker make a film this good? And I just point to Bob Sarles and say, find a guy like that. That's the genius that really helped bring this thing over the top.
See, on a much, much, much smaller level, I know what you're talking about, because when I do have a day job, when I'm working, I story produce for reality television. So I would put together my rudimentary cut and I would hand it off to the editor. And I would tell him, do whatever you want. You know what I mean?
Right.
Basically.
Yeah.
And then I would go in and he would show me. I'm like, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And so then when the producers would come in to give us notes, you know, he'd be turning to me and going, Pat, this is fantastic. And I'd just be like, it's that guy did
it.
I mean, I gave him the groundwork, but then he put all the bells and whistles and made it great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Bob brought all his best people in. I could just, you know, spend a half hour naming them all, but like, you know, at every level, whether it was like the graphics designer or, you know, Barry Goldberg, the legendary, you know, blues musician to give us incidental music. I mean, at every stop, Bob brought his best people in. And, you know, even to this day, he's still helping me produce his DVD because, you know, he knows what he's doing and I do not.
Because the DVD, home video is the end game for something like this, because no matter how great it is, and this is great, it's hard to get screens to not show Marvel Infinity War so that they can show, you know, bang, the burn story.
Yeah.
It's tough.
It's tough to get a theatrical release for a documentary, especially an indie one. But yeah, we had a pretty good size U.S. theatrical.
Yeah.
We got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, yeah, and the New York Times gave us a pull quote of, you'll love this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it just really was an extraordinary run. We would have kept going in the theaters, but we got this really great opportunity to work with Apple Music and iTunes. And so we pulled the film out of the theaters, even though at the time it was the hottest music documentary in the country with the highest per theater averages and
that's
the best
amazing
reviewed and all this stuff. And, you know, the only thing the film didn't get really was Academy Award nomination or Grammy nomination. It didn't get those. And I think if more people had seen it, it might have, but
yeah,
we didn't make the movie for those awards.
Right.
We got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame statue, which is the ultimate reward.
Right. Your dad's a music guy. It's about music. That's what you want. You
yeah
want the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame adulation.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to see it now. That's what's great. Everyone is going to see it who wants to see it.
Yeah, we're aiming for, you know, American Masters. You know, I'm not holding my breath because that's pretty tricky to get on there. But it's the quintessential New York story, and American Masters is out of New York City. So, you know, we're hoping
is
by the
PBS?
End of the
year.
That's PBS.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, again, the audience is mostly are you know, the older who are watching PBS
yeah
and buying DVDs, you know, so
yeah,
we're,
but this is for those people too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's for, you know, young people are going to hear this music too and be, you know, they're going to be like, wow, when did that music come out? Before
yeah
I was born? Amazing.
Ultimately, if young people, and I think it is happening, if they can latch onto this story and see what it takes to make great art and, you know, the hard work that it takes and the dedication, I think if it inspires the younger generation, then we've really gone to the bonus level. And Stephen Van Zandt's Rock and Roll Forever Foundation is going to do a course around the film later this year.
That's fantastic.
So we will be getting it into schools.
My 13-year-old is so into the Beatles right now. That's like all she's listening to, which I think everyone goes through that phase. But then it's not a phase because once you discover it, you love it forever.
Forever.
But my oldest daughter, she is she loves the Zombies and she loves the Kinks. I mean, she loves it. So
that great taste.
I know. I'm excited. That way we have stuff to play in the car when we're driving to school.
Right.
I want to play Solomon Burke because we talked about him a lot. I don't think we've played anything from him. Let's play Everybody Needs Somebody to Love by Solomon Burke, and then we'll hear the Rolling Stones take a stab at that also.
Everybody needs somebody. Everybody wants somebody to love. Honey to honey, sugar to kiss. To miss now, yeah. Baby to tease, sometime to please, yeah. And I need
you,
and I need
you
in the morning, baby.
It's so casual,
yeah.
Just the hand claps are just
ain't nobody around, sugar.
All right, I'm gonna go right into the Stones. Here we go. Fantastic.
It's amazing. And then there's the Blues Brothers, which is, you know, like one of my all-time favorite, maybe the best cover.
There it is.
Them.
Everybody. Everybody.
Everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs somebody to love. Someone to love.
Someone to love.
Sweetheart to miss.
Sweetheart to miss.
Sugar to kiss.
Sugar to kiss.
I gotta be honest, the Blues Brothers turned stupid white teenage boys onto the blues.
Right.
You know, you saw them on Saturday Night Live and I don't know if I knew where that music came from. I didn't know if maybe they wrote it or Paul Schaefer wrote them.
Right.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. There's Delbert McClinton songs and all that kind of stuff they were doing.
Yeah.
You know, I never listened to that type of music, but I listened to the Blues Brothers albums. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah.
You never know how it's going to filter into your, your life.
It's true.
Well, look, I didn't call you Bert the whole time. I'm so happy. We didn't talk about Jerry Wexler, but we'll save that for the movie. I did not like that guy.
Yeah, he's the hero of the Bert Brun story and also a villain.
And he's your godfather.
He's my godfather. He was best man at the wedding. When you look at the Bert Brun story, he's the guy who really did the most to give my dad a leg up. And
yeah,
there was like a father-son relationship that went terribly wrong at the end.
Yeah, which is sad.
Yeah, it's sad. It's sad. And, I wished I had, met him and tried to reconcile, maybe even somehow, as Bert's son. And I called him when I came out of the army. My mother put me up to it without telling me anything about what had happened.
Just hand you the phone.
Yeah, yeah. And I said, hey, I'd love to meet you. And he said, well, it sounds like you don't know what happened between your father and I at the end of days. And if you still want to meet me after you found out, give me a call. And I mean, the blood had rushed out of my head by this point, and I was just shaking. And I'm like, okay, thank you. I'll speak to you soon. And, it took me, better part of a decade to learn what he was talking about. Mm. And
your mom didn't fill you in?
My mom started telling me this story when I was 6 years old. She'd crawl into bed with me in the middle of the night, a little bit drunk from being out working in the record business. And she'd, start crying and missing my dad. And she'd say, your father wasn't a gangster. Your father wasn't a gangster. I don't ever want you to think of your father as a gangster.
And you're like, I'm just trying to sleep, Mom.
I'm just trying to sleep, Mom. What are you talking about? So, she started to tell me at a young age, and I would hear whispers of the mob. And, you know, so I'd go into some place and some guy would walk to me and say, you know, your father was really mobbed up. And I mean, it was like that kind of a thing. And yeah, so. You know,
first of all, you have nothing to do with that.
Yeah, I mean.
So it's so weird that when people want to just want to tell you things like that about your parents or whoever, your great uncle, whatever. And you're just like, that's got nothing to do with me.
I know. I was like this preppy, geeky kid that had no idea what they were talking about. And, you know, when I did meet Wazzle later in life, and I couldn't understand a word he said for the first, you know, year that I met him. But and then I started to meet some other people and I learned really how deep it went. And, you know, Wazzle, you know, he said, on the record, Tommy Eboli said to me, on the record, you watch the wife and the kids. And that was right there at the funeral home. Like, you know, my dad was a closed coffin. My mother only let Tommy come in and see Bert. And he said that to Wazzle on the record, which I learned is mob speak for literally what it sounds like. And on his deathbed, Wazzle, 90 years old, said, you know, your whole life, your kid didn't know it, but you had the mob behind you. And I was like, wow, Wazzle, thanks for telling me now. No, but,
I did want to ask if any of these the co-songwriters or any of the people we've talked about other than the mob guys, if they, when your dad had passed, were they surrogate uncles? Were they still in, you know, friendly with your mom and friendly with the family?
Yes. So many of these guys, like I said, stood in the gap. You know, growing up in Atlanta, I really didn't know many of them, and we were sort of too far away because they were all in New York or in L.A. But I did start to meet them again once I sort of grew into manhood, and it was like Jerry Ragavoy and Don Drowdy and Jeff Barry and Brooks Arthur and Gary Sherman, who's one of the stars of the film and arranger and orchestrator who's working with us on the musical still. I mean, he's standing in the shoes of the composer in the musical, and that's one of the reasons why the New York Times called the show gorgeously tuneful.
There you go.
Thank you, Gary. But, you know, Bob Feldman, the Strangeloves, those guys, I mean, I could just keep going on and on. They, you know, they stood in the gap and they taught me who my dad was, and I'll be forever grateful to them.
So when you're sitting down to film their interviews, they're excited for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Bob Sorrell says that the reason why the film comes off, one of the reasons the way it does, is because these interviews poured their hearts out to the son of this long lost friend of theirs. And, you know, my nervousness was very obvious. And so I feel like they just took a different approach, I think, to the interview. If Martin Scorsese had interviewed them, it wouldn't have been as much love, would have come out of it.
Yeah, they wanted to do a good job for you.
I think so. I think they felt for me and they realized that we were on a, as John Belushi said, a mission from God. This has really been
now, like, when I watch it again, I'm going to look at it from that angle because, you're right. That's why this is a little bit different.
Yeah, there's so much love in these interviews. And, you know, you could say, like, okay, well, is this a puff piece? Is this a hagiography? You know, are they not telling the whole story? And I think when you see the film, you see, like, we throw my dad on the sword a couple times. We tell as true a story as we can.
Yeah.
In the musical, we made him so good. He was like, you know, we had to actually rough him up a little bit because he was like too good. So he was a just man. He was a great just man.
Last question. Did your mom ever remarry?
Yes, several times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, she married Eddie Bisco and had two sons, two boys. Eddie Bisco was the great white promotion man at Motown.
Wow.
There's great stories about him. You know, she hooked up with Nigel Olsen, the drummer for Elton John, you know, for a period. So, like, you know, we grew up, you know, it was real rock and roll.
You grew up around rock and roll still.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if it was going to be, no, she never did, this was the love of her life, or no, she married once. But it was the
love of her life. You know, she never got over my father's death. And I think that haunted her to the day that she died. And so, you know, all the different men that came in and went, none of them measured up to
my dad. They were just placeholders.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's another thing about the movie. It is a love story. I'm going on and on about it, but it really is. You will not be disappointed at all.
That's what Steven Van Zandt says. He says, somebody said, it's a mob story. He goes, it's not a mob story. It's a love story.
It is. It's your dad's love of music and people's love of your dad. And then your dad and your mom. It's fantastic. I got a whole list of songs. Let's do some little promoting. And then you can tell me what you might want the play out song to be. Because we didn't play Let the Water Run Down.
Oh, I love Let the Water Run Down.
Would that be the play out of Benny King song?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, let's do that one. So you can go to BertBurns.com. That's BERTBERNS.com. You can also go to BangTheBertBurnsStory.com.
Right.
Is there a Twitter account? Are you on Twitter?
There is a Twitter account, but most of our following is on Facebook.
Okay.
We're self-distributing the DVD through an imprint because I've grown up in the music business, so this is not difficult to do. And, again, we'll have the film on television broadcast in the fall, but, for the next few months, we're really going to be trying to let people know that the film is available on DVD.
And is the film, I think I asked you this already, but I forget what you said, is the film on iTunes right now? Can you buy the film on iTunes currently?
Yes. It's on Apple Music. So if you're an Apple Music subscriber, you can watch it for free.
Okay,
And it's on iTunes as well. And the hour of extras, which are pretty phenomenal. I know everybody thinks their extras are, mm-hmm. Great stuff, but we've got some extraordinary extras in the can here, and there's a whole hour of it. And those are available both on iTunes if you purchase the film and in the DVD.
And on the DVD. And DVD comes out June 1st. Just so you know, this episode will drop next Thursday.
Great.
Which is, I think, the 24th. So we got a whole week of people can find this thing, this movie, this your labor of love.
Yes.
I call it a thing.
It is. It's a thing, too.
Let's promote this show a little bit. We are on at Rock Solid Show on Twitter. I am at Pat_Francis. And Kyle, who's not here tonight, is at Kyle.SomeFunny. Like us on Facebook. Go to the website, rocksolidpodcast.com. Go to the Patreon page, patreon.com/rocksolidpodcast. And thank you so much, Brett, for being here. This was fantastic. I love sitting down with you. I can really see it in your smile and your eyes, what joy making this film did for you. And I hope that it got you closer to your dad. I hope that helped. And for your sister and your other siblings also.
It really has. It's like you said, it's been a long labor of love, and we've brought our dad back to life on the living stage and the musical, and now with this film. And, I just can't thank you enough for shining a light on the legacy.
This is my pleasure. And look, whenever I see something that I love, I'm like, I want to tell people about it. And bang, the Burt Burns story is one of those things. So let's play out with a song of your choosing. This is the great Benny King. You know him from Stand By Me, but this is a song called Let the Water Run Down. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, Pat.
I run to the room, turn on the faucet. I let the water run. I don't want to let her hear me. When I'm crying, won't let her see what she has done. Whoa.
Let the water run down.
Let it run, let it run. So I locked the door and looked in the mirror. I don't like what I see. A fool, what a fool, looking out of that mirror, crying all those tears at me. Whoa, just let it run, let it run. I hear them banging by the door. Stop that banging on the door. They're yelling, are you coming out? Oh, I wish they wouldn't shout. All I need's 1 minute more. Then I'll open up the door. And this is...